greatest challenges facing us. That is a challenge just to try to look at those challenges, isn't it? The questions that we are to address has to do particularly with the rising generation, our young people. And then, are we lethargic? Are we impotent? And some looking at tradition, friend or foe. We are a group that there's at least this evidence of taking our Christian life seriously, in that there's a lot of shifting around, of reconfiguring the lines of fellowship. And I'm inclined to think that this is often done with pure motives and a good conscience. But it's not altogether unlikely that it can happen with other motives, and that our motive can be something other than a real honesty and openness before the Lord. It's sometimes difficult to separate selfish motivation to a spirit of Christ and a position, a disposition of servanthood. When we try to evaluate the present state of the church, it's quite a challenge, really, and I think the reference to the yearbooks that I made in the earlier session would give some indication of how diverse we really are. But then some of projects, I'm not sure what to call them, a ministry, such as Faith Builders and of SMBI and some of the other Bible schools and things that occur at Penn Valley. I think those are all efforts to try to break out from our narrow identities and trying to join hands with a larger community to do things that we can well do together. I think that our young people many times wonder why we're not a little more aggressive and a little more successful in incorporating others into the church. And I'm not sure how to respond to all that, because we certainly do value the presence of our young people among us. And they bring an element, a dimension of energy and vision, idealism, that I'm not sure, I mean, it seems to me the churches could ill afford to do without. I don't know if it's how far we should go with this sort of introspection, examining who we are and how we operate, but I'm assuming that the community that I come from is more or less typical. And we, of course, have our regular weekly and biweekly services. And we do reach out to several old people's homes, rest homes in the area for ministry. There are prisons, state prisons, located in our county. And we have brethren who, on a weekly basis, go into this prison to have Bible study with some of the inmates who want to come. And we have also some brethren participating in the annual prison ministry was originally at Atmore, Alabama. It's still there and out from that place. We have some work in India. By the way, there's a brother here from India who works with our people as an interpreter when they go over there, and he's in attendance here. And he is just seems to be enjoying his experience here in North America quite a lot. But I think we can depend on it. He's looking around and he is getting impressions. And we shouldn't be uncomfortable about that. We could say on the one hand that we believe we are doing some things right. But when I talk like that, I'm always pretty self-conscious, because I remember that the Church of Laodicea felt they were pretty much doing things right, And their perception of themselves was very different than God's perception. And so I would say to us this afternoon, let's not assume that we have arrived. Let's not assume that we have need of nothing, because that in itself is an indication that we don't see things as they really are. It's a tremendous challenge to read their own evaluation and then see what God says about them. He says that, but I would say to us then in connection with that, let us by God's grace try to see ourselves from God's perspective. But of the church at Laodicea, he said that they were poor and wretched and naked and blind, and they thought they didn't need a thing. But I think a lot of what we're concerned about this afternoon, how do we engage our young people in a way that they feel part of the team, that they feel involved, and how do we benefit from their energy, their idealism, and so on. It's pretty common that we hear that young people somehow feel like they've been handed things that they had no part in putting into place. And that's an understandable concern. And I don't know, it seems to me from what I can learn from the scriptures, that it's God's ideal that the different age groups blend together in an effort that is cooperative, that we're allies, we're not somehow in competition with each other. I believe that's God's ideal. And it's true that the young people among us, they sort of inherit some things that they had no part in putting into place. And I think we as older people should be willing to hear and to perhaps re-examine things like that. But I would appeal to young people who are here this afternoon that they would try to understand leaders' perspective in this. How often should one update in order to keep the young people involved? You know, in where I come from, we have birthdays once a year, and I think that's pretty universal. And so what that means is that we have a constant influx of people being added to the youth group. And without exception, young people could say that we had nothing to say to this. Now what are we supposed to do with it? Well, one thing that I would remind us this afternoon, that's not unique to this generation. Every rising generation has always inherited things that they had no part in making. And so I think, I mean, I hesitated in a way to say this, and yet I felt this was the time and place to say it. We were instructed that we should feel free to say whatever, you know, needs to be said. And so I would hope that those comments don't in any way alienate young people who are here wondering, well, where do we fit in, or how can we make a difference? And we are all so wired that, you know, we all want to make a difference. We all want to be useful. And I'm going to quote a person that I didn't look up to particularly, but I used to read her quite a lot when she would write an advice column. Ann Landers was quoted to have spoken to a group of young people. And she said, how many of you expect to be wiser in 20 to 30 years than you are now? And of course, there was a unanimous response. And her counsel was, well, that's where your parents are now. Just listen to them. And I know that can seem like an oversimplification, but I think it has a ring of truth and authenticity. And I think that Satan would seek to sort of polarize these different age groups. And I think it's God's intention to bring us together and have us to work together, recognizing each other's strengths and capitalizing on them, becoming allies and not competitors. We understand, you know, if you're around young people, why, their middle name seems to be energy many times. And I can understand the trial of patience, and when they feel like the older generation is stuck somewhere in neutral or a lower gear at least. But I think God is able to bring this together in a very useful, a very productive way. If we were to turn to the scriptures this afternoon, we would find that the scriptures appeal to young men because they are strong, and to the older men because they have known the Lord. I don't have that all together at the moment. But the idea of a generation gap is really somehow foreign to the concept of Scripture. But the challenges that face us, that's one of the challenges, that we are firmly committed to work together and to approach our problems that way. Now, we touched on some of this morning, but let's face it, the pressures of acculturation are very real in our day. I'm not sure how to go from here, but the prevailing culture has a tremendous pull. And as I indicated earlier, it's not appropriate, I don't think, to look at them and say we somehow have to be different. But if we are committed to the Word, and we are committed to loyalty to God's people, and then it will make a difference. Now, when I observe this group, it's obvious that there are different applications of people with similar concerns, and that doesn't particularly concern me. However, if there's a trend that is gradually moving in the direction of simply a non-identity with God's people, an identity with the world, with the culture, and then that does concern me. But there are non-conformity, of course, goes much deeper than are the externals. But isn't it true at the same time that if we, if the external is not important at all, that we simply violate some very basic principles that are very clearly taught in the Word of God? I mentioned some of this earlier this morning. And so what are the biggest challenges facing us? Well, number one, the first thing I would mention is it's a challenge of keeping the generations together. And I don't know about a lot of your groups, but we are very grateful for the young people who stand firmly with us. They want to be part of us, and they want to do whatever they can. I was blessed. Before I left home, a young man stepped up to me, and he said he'd just been to Bible school. He had this fresh on his mind, and he had read something of this program. He said, "I'd like to have a recording of what goes on here." You know, a person like that is different than the person who says, "I don't know about this stuff." And we have both kinds. But it's important that we somehow make them allies. Well, another thing that I would observe is that we can go several directions in working with our young people. We can sort of write them off and say that they haven't had the experience. Or we can welcome what they have to say to us and realize that unless we're at least somewhat young at heart, we've about lost our usefulness. But I've been in circles that have emphasized very much the importance of young people to the point that they pretty much turn things over to them. I doubt very seriously that that's God's intention. Let me give you, for instance, of how that can work. We live in a community that is over 100 years old. And more we seem to have all the different options for people to attend church. About 60 years ago, there was a group organized. And I mentioned this morning, I hope that we're not committed to speak only in generic language. I hope that we can be free to say what we need to say. But They came out of an Amish background, the background of which I was a part, and they organized under Conservative Mennonite Conference. And I could follow their reasoning. I never felt that the Lord called me to join the movement, but there were a lot of good things happened in that church. They would bring in good speakers, and others of us would attend the services. And it was really a very, I would see it as a very positive development there for them. They may have had some attitudes that were a little bit reactionary, and that is never good. I think whatever our background is, let's guard against being reactionary against our background, because that changes the focus somehow of where it belongs to where it doesn't belong. If we are reactionary, we react against something that we're really not much in favor of, and that becomes our focus. May have been a bit of that, but now their starting date was 1948, and they've had a gradual, of course, transition of leadership, and the youth in that community have become very, very active, and I would say concerned, perhaps. They also have the background of having attended public schools, both grade school and high school, and they've had exposure to instrumental music there, and this has become pretty important to them, to some of them. And they have in recent years acquired a property that is adjacent to where we live in the little town of Partridge. As I say adjacent, it's just across the way a little bit. And they've acquired an abandoned public school, just a grade school. It's kind of a dwarf compared to these facilities, but it's a good-sized facility for them to do things. And they have met there regularly, at least part of the time, or on a Sunday afternoon, for the purpose of practicing band. Well, that was a far cry from the way they started out. But I see it as a direct result of wanting to give their young people whatever they wanted. And now it's at the place where band music sometimes comes to church on a Sunday morning, complete with all the noises, and some of the older people just about can't handle it. Well, now, what am I saying? I'm saying that there is a right way and a wrong way to respond to what our youth are interested in. And to me, whenever we would turn it over to the youth, how things should go without the corresponding or the balancing influence of people who have gone the way before, I think things can very quickly move in a direction that probably isn't very stable. You know, but another thing that I would point out as a very serious challenge is something that's been brought up here, that is how we relate to the evangelical community. And it's not realistic for us to make some declaration of independence that we won't be influenced by them. When you pick up your hymn books, most of those hymns weren't written by Anabaptists. And let's face it, they are, you know, the evangelical Protestant influence permeates a lot of what we read. But I hinted at this morning, that I feel we should be mature enough to have an openness to what they say is right and good, but we also have the maturity to say no to the things that lead us away from the simplicity of God's Word and the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And I don't think it's realistic for us to assume that we can somehow organize a system that is, speaking in spiritual terms now, is sanitary. You know, we don't risk any exposure, any interaction, because that wouldn't be safe. I don't think that's realistic. I think we can become so sanitary that we actually become sterile. You know what I mean? We over-sanitize. And there are people, there are groups, I think, who would move in that direction. And, of course, the other part is very much with us, that we can become so liberal with our interaction that we err on the other side. But if we are rooted and grounded on that which is true, that provides a tremendous amount of protection against these kinds of extremes. On our way out here, we spent the night near Goshen with longtime friends of ours. He is not an ordained man, but he was a successful businessman. He's also taken some interest in Christian counseling. And I know that can be kind of a sensitive term to use in our circles, but I would plead that we don't allow it to become so sensitive that we are not interested in seeing people who need counseling get help that they need. And he does something that probably wouldn't be advisable for a young person that wasn't pretty stable. But he drives to Oak Lawn, which is a mental health facility, and he counsels people there regularly. What do you suppose? Who do you suppose his clientele is? Would you guess? Would you know, Val? Amish. Well, Amish people need counseling. If they're Amish, why would they need counseling? It's because they're human. They have problems. But he interacts with people who are very different than he is. But he reaches out, and his motive and his interest is to help people find wholeness in Christ. He's very committed to what the Bible says. But he would also say that there are other tools that can sometimes be useful in helping people through some very serious struggles. I would say, let's be a separate people, but let's not be isolationist to the point that we can't reach out and help others in need. And let's also be willing to, let's be very liberal, may I say, in helping people who may be more liberal than we, or helping people who may be less so than we. Let's be the kind of people who are eager to reach out. And let's be allies. Let's not assume that our young people or the older people are somehow need to be a part in their thinking. I recently heard a message was preached by Laban Kaufman over at Penn Valley. The message was preached, and they had given him this topic: the church. Is it a museum? Is it a restaurant? And what was the other one? Somebody remember? What was it? Hospital. There you go. And he made a point of the fact that Jesus invariably noticed the outcast. And he expressed this burden, and I think it's a burden that we do well to share. Let's not be so correct. Let's not be so preoccupied with our orthodoxy that we somehow lose the ability to reach out and to help the person who is down and out. Those things don't need to conflict, but they can. You know what I mean? And I believe the person who visits our worship services, or the person that we meet wherever, he should sense that we are people who care. We are people who love him. We are people who love the Lord. And if that's missing, we have a big problem. But my concern and my appeal is quite simply that whatever ages are here, and you know I haven't taken a real close survey here, but I sometimes do that, look around for people who were born before I was. I'm not sure if there's some people like that here or not. I would find it interesting to reword that a little bit, you know, instead of trying to discover who's oldest. Maybe we could look at it, who's been young the longest? You know, it's after all, there's part of these things are the way you look at them. And so I would like to say to the young people here, I know that we were born at different times. Really had no control over that. But consider your older persons in the church your allies. Interact with them freely. Communicate with them openly. And I would like to think they would hear what you have to say. Maybe I should give special recognition to the team that went from here and did something rather creative in a survey of how we're viewed by the public. Maybe others of you have read what happened. They interviewed here in Shipshewan, Indiana, got a pretty interesting response of what other people think of us. But the important thing is, what does God think of us?
There are two titles that have been given to us as a label historically. One is the quiet in the land, and the other is the radicals. The quiet in the land speaks of our calling to maintenance, maintaining that which we believe, maybe. The radicals has more of a proactive feeling to it, somewhere we're getting involved. The quiet in the land maybe attaches itself more to preserving, to holding fast that which we have been given. The radicals has more of the idea of initiation, getting initiated into something, the go ye therefore concept that the scripture has. Both are so essential to being Mennonites on the cutting edge. We need the holding fast. We also need the go ye therefore. As we mentioned this morning, I believe we've done fairly well. Let's not pat ourselves on the back too much, but we've done fairly well, maybe better than many, in the maintaining area. I remember very well going with my father to pick up ladies in the community who were coming to our church back in the early 50s. And as we'd pick them up, they would almost always have something on their head as they would come to our church. Even though they were Lutheran in background and were not a part of our church, they were going to the church in the closest church to them. They would put something on their head. That was back in the 50s. There are very few Lutheran ladies who will do that today as they go to church. I think it was Walter Beechey who mentioned that in his grandmother's day in Plain City, you would have a very difficult time being able to tell the difference between the Methodist ladies and the Amish ladies as they walked down the street. Said if you looked across the street, you would not be able to tell the difference. But if you got up close to them, you'd see a few more frills on the Methodist ladies and maybe a wedding band. But from the distance, you couldn't tell the difference between the two. In our Mennonite tradition, family units are still fairly strong. So I think we've done a fairly good job in the area of maintenance. But if maintaining Anabaptism is not linked with proactive involvement, if our holding fast is not coupled with go ye therefore, I'm convinced that Anabaptism will become extinct except as a spectacle for tourism. And that was already mentioned, that a college professor brought his church back to the area there that Brother David is from to see what they used to be like. A number of years ago, Brother Collier Berkshire was with us at Sharon Mennonite Bible Institute for our Pastor's Minister's Week. Collier asked, I think it was between 40 and 50 pastors that were there, how many of them had five or more people from non-Mennonite roots? There was one pastor raised his hand. I think that's fairly indicative across the church of our demographics. When churches divide due to dissension and rather than evangelism, we're in the maintenance mode. When churches grow only due to childbirth, we're in the maintenance mode. If marriage and material things characterizes our vision, we're in the maintenance mode. Now, marriage and material things are important. They are tools, though, to something far bigger and far more important. Luke Kipfer was questioned by one pastor After he had been talking about some of the exploits that some of the young men were being involved in as they went into closed access countries, I don't know exactly which countries those were, but as he was sharing about that, this pastor began to question Luke and said, is it safe to send those young people into those particular cultures, those countries, those closed access countries? And I loved Luke's response. He said, no, it's not safe. He says, but we're not here to be safe. We're here to be dangerous. The gates of hell will not prevail against the kingdom of God. Luke chapter 10, verse 3 says, we're going to be like lambs among wolves. That's not safe. If we're concerned about staying where it's safe, we're in a maintenance mode. Was it safe for Felix Mons to face the city council? Is it safe for the underground church in China to take the gospel back to Jerusalem? Was it safe for the 10 booms to shelter the Jews? Was it safe for Stephen to preach to those high priests? Was it safe for Pablo Yoder to stay in Waslala? Was it safe for Ken Miller and those that were with him to take that native boy home there in Kenya, ending up with the burning of that mission vehicle and nearly the killing of those missionaries? As important as maintenance mode is, it will never be compelling by itself. Where there is no go ye therefore, there probably will not be any holding fast either. Oh, that we once again were worthy of the term radical. God calls us to maintenance, but he also calls us to trailblazing, to adventure, to battle, to escapades, to risking our lives for the sake of building the kingdom. The greatest challenge facing us in 2005, I believe, is providing the go ye therefore models for young Anabaptists. I think of John and Joseph Overholt, two men that were radicals. I didn't know them well, and a lot of what I do know about them came second and third hand, so I may not be completely accurate in all of this, but I remember hearing that Brother Joseph Overholt was so involved in ministry and so forth that he was scheduled to go down into the Central American countries somewhere and to have some meetings down there, but was busy with his trying to get his farm things done so he could get going and didn't have time to change. Went driving down to the airport, got on the airplane, still in his barn clothes with, I guess, manure on his shoes. I don't know. After he got in the air, he went back into the bathroom and changed into his travel clothes. Now, I don't know how you do that in those bathrooms. But it was a vision of John and Joseph that actually was part of the beginning of the work in New York City that is going on there today. Men who were radicals, who gathered up a lot of young people and said, let's go do some street preaching. They're in New York City. I think of Irvin and Susan Shantz hooking up the travel trailer behind their car and heading for Michigan to plant churches. Plant a few there, then felt the call of God to come on into the area I'm from, northern Minnesota, planted 14, 15 churches there, and then God called them on into northwestern Ontario, and the whole mission that is going up there now in the Anabaptist circles is a result of that. As those people were serving the Lord in that far-off, uttermost parts of the world, as it was back in those days, they spread their bread with lard because they did not have butter. They had primitive housing where they'd live downstairs in about a 16 by 20 little shack and sleep in the loft upstairs And the heat coming from downstairs up through the ceiling was all that kept the upstairs warm in below 40 degree temperatures. Mavericks. But there was lots of people who have been involved in that ministry over the years because someone had a vision. Think of Count Zinzendorf, his mansion becoming a training facility. If I understand history right, for 200 years, there was a prayer meeting that never stopped in that household. More missionaries were sent out by that group in 20 years, I'm told by some historians at least, than all the rest of Europe sent out in 200. In the early 1980s, there was a tremendous interest in New York City by young people. Some of the students at SMBI would leave on weekends and go out into Brooklyn. They slept on the tables. They slept under the tables. They ate only rice and beans. They had one small apartment for, I think, 25, 30 people that were staying there over the weekend. And they were captured by a vision for that city. Not because it was easy, not because it was nice, but because it was hard. Early part of this decade, we had some young men who were carrying food into genocide victims, walking right past encampments, enemy encampments, and they were having to step very cautiously so they would not step on landmines over in Asia. I really believe that we are full of young people who are willing to take the risks to get involved. Many volunteers who said, we'll go over there to help with that tsunami relief. Many more than they could use. What's the challenge to us as Anabaptists in 2005? I'd like to suggest three. These are certainly not exhaustive, but just three challenges. I believe, number one, we must get our eyesight off of retirement. If middle-aged Anabaptists dream of retiring in some vacation land city of the South, they'll never live out a lifestyle that will reflect a compelling vision for the next generation. The second thing is we must study those who have gone before us, those that are giving a compelling vision to their people. I really believe that Martyr's Mirror ought to be a regular part of our educational historical systems, our requirements for history. People who knew what it was like to live and die for a cause that was bigger than what they were involved in personally. We have a parallel contemporary demonstration of that in the Chinese church. The suffering that's taken place there. We had it in history. They have it now. They are sending their best workers, their most experienced workers, their best equipped workers into that vision to take the gospel from China back to Jerusalem. They are sending the ones that have at least 10 years of experience. We have, I'm afraid, a distressing record of pulling our best back home to take care of our churches at home rather than sending them out and saying, you need to have 10 years of experience at home, then we're going to send you out. If we're going to be radical, we're going to have to do some things different. When they leave home, they expect persecution. They don't think it might happen. They expect it will happen. Of the first 39 people who were sent out by the underground church in China, 36 of them were arrested and put in prison or taken back home. Only three made it, but the church wept with joy that three had gotten through. And the other 36, before long, tried again. Many of them were able to get through after a second or third attempt. Others return, as the time goes on, more are returning and getting involved in that. We question, is it safe? No, it's not safe. But we're not here to be safe. We're here for a battlefield. The underground church in China trains their workers to cross cultural barriers. We've been talking about that today. They train them to target specific groups, learn their language, learn how to get the gospel understandable in their cultural background. They train them to witness in all situations, whether they're on the train, on buses, in police cars, even if they're on their way to execution, they're training them how to witness. These workers are spiritual suicide bombers. They know they need to go. They don't know if they need to come back. They train them how to escape. They train them how to jump out of second-story windows to the ground without hurting themselves. They train them to how to get out of handcuffs in 30 seconds. I'd like to learn that myself. We must study the underground church in China and those kind of movements, even in our own Anabaptist history, Martyrs' Mirror and so forth, if we're going to have a compelling vision that's bigger than our culture and our background. The third thing, third challenge. First one, get our eyesight off of retirement. Second one, we must study those who have gone before us with this kind of radical involvement in kingdom building. The third thing is we must kindle the fire of conquest in young men. We must kindle the fire of conquest in young men. The God-given drive for conquest is innate in young men. But if we don't give them a vision, it will get sedated into sports endeavors and other things like that. When our teaching of non-resistance is not coupled with a conquest for the kingdom, we're going to raise a generation of wimps. Yellow soldiers who enjoy coffee time instead of battle time. Our weapons are not carnal, but neither are they non-existent. They are mighty to the pulling down of strongholds. I want to say this in closing. Middle-aged American Anabaptists must have captured and continue to capture a vision of kingdom building that calls forth the wisdom of the aged and the daring of the young. This vision must include both the maintenance of the faith and the proactive aggression of works. Our challenge involves holding fast while we go therefore. Thank you.
American conference, and the moderator gave me the lapel mic as I got up to speak, and he said, no, with good Native American humor, he said, you know, we found that these tend to work best if you kind of clip them on your left nostril. So I'm really glad that I haven't had to do that here. It's a lot less, a lot more painless. What are our greatest challenges in 2005? Well, change is always a challenge. Elmo Stoll said in Family Life magazine, June 1990, the cash economy came to us in the name of progress and efficiency, but I'm afraid it's not progress. Because in a subtle way, in a sneaky, below-the-surface, behind-the-scenes sort of way, it changes our entire way of living. Worse yet, it changes our way of thinking. When that line of reasoning is followed to its logical end, it will put our lives out of balance, alter our lifestyles and our communities. It is a kind of reasoning, if we pursue it in the future as we have in the past, that will eventually destroy our Christian values in our homes, communities, and churches, even as it has already done so in the larger society around us. I would suggest to you that our greatest challenge is the materialism of North American society. We tend to see our wealth as a gift from God, but my question is the wealth of North America the gift of God, or is it an entrapment tool of the devil to distract the church from the real task at hand? How we deal with cash and how we deal with wealth influences the way we live, how we think, and how we live our lives, and how we relate to the larger society. It's fascinating. A few years ago, I was at Maranatha Bible School for Missions Emphasis Weekend, and we did Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Sunday evening. So Friday night, we had the mission service, and Saturday was kind of a free day. So all but maybe two or three students left for the day, and they came back at supper time, and we had the evening mission service. And so I was talking to some of the students and saying, "So what did you guys do today?" "Well," he said, "we went to Minneapolis and went to Mall of America, watched an IMAX film, went to Applebee's for lunch, and did some shopping and came back." I'm thinking, wow, like which world do these students live in? And when you get a group of people, and when they have the opportunity to do whatever they want to do, Mall of America, IMAX, and Applebee's are where they head. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Mall of America or Applebee's or IMAX, but there's a disconnection between how we live most of our lives, most of the time, and what we do for church. And that disconnection is becoming greater and greater in our communities. And as we assimilate into the larger society based on economics and our interaction with the larger economy in the marketplace, we assimilate in the way we think and in the way we live out our lives on a daily basis. I often think of, I remember as a young man, Homer Miller from Northern Indiana was at our church for a week of meetings, and he was talking about being raised in wherever he was raised, and I forget, but probably Northern Indiana in the Amish community. And as I remember it, and I don't know if I remember Craig, but as I remember it, he said that he could count on one hand the number of times that he went to town before he was 16 years old. So now, when you think of the lives of our grandparents, and you think of our lives today, and our interaction with society, there has been tremendous change. When you think of the wealth in our communities, and you think of where that wealth comes from, there's been tremendous change. But that change hasn't only been restricted to economics. It has influenced and permeates our lives in many, many ways. I am no longer surprised when we get men on staff, married or single, who are recommended as the cream of the crop from their congregation. But when they arrive and you learn to know them and you find out what's going on in their lives, I'm not surprised anymore to find out that men who are considered the cream of the crop in our congregations are living in moral defeat and are living with moral failure and have sexual addictions, pornography addictions. But what surprises me is the hardest thing for those men is often to contact their home pastor and say, "This is what's been going on in my life." And I think it says something about our sense of community and the image that we present, even within the community. where the community is no longer a safe place to say, I'm struggling. It's no longer a safe place to say, how do I deal with the challenges of life? How do I deal with my interactions with society? These are things that I'm struggling with. I don't know what to do. And when the last place we want to turn is to our pastor and our church community, we have lost the sense of community. Where is the community and the sense of community that will help us to mentor and disciple our young people and show them this is how life is lived? Can we as middle-aged and older people be honest enough and open enough about our own struggles that we can talk to our youth and say, I have challenges, I have struggles, this is how I deal with it. How are you dealing with it? That's part of being community. My suggestion to you this afternoon is that we have, or are in the process, and I'm stating this as some of it has already happened, but what I'm saying is we are in the process of assimilating into North American culture. We are losing our sense of identity as a distinct people. And when we think about how we put together an identity, we think of everyday life, we think of interaction within the larger group and our own perceived traditions and history. When we think about the life of our grandfathers, their everyday life was an agrarian society. Agriculture was the base of the economy. German language was the predominant language. There was limited interaction with people outside the Anabaptist community. There was a sharing of resources and labor. A lot of the farmers didn't have enough of equipment to do everything themselves, and so they shared equipment. The men would do harvesting together. The women would do quilting and canning together. And there was a lot of group interaction that happened just in the context of everyday life. There was caring for the needs of others within the community, and time was more readily available than money. And so it was much easier to get together and help somebody build a new barn than it was to take an offering and give them the money to build a new barn. And so that was the life of our grandparents. In the larger group interaction, the church was the place of worship, and for some groups, it was the home. And so the church was just an extension of community life. It was something that happened as a part of the larger community, and the people that you went to church with on Sunday morning were people that they lived next to you. You got together to do harvesting, you canned and quilted with them, and you did things together, and you knew each other, and you knew each other's children, and you did things, everything was, a lot of things were done together. And then going to church, it was the same people. There was structured leadership in the church. There was value given to being an insider, and there was a mistrust of those outside the community, and you had a confidence and a trust within the community by being an insider. The perceived traditions and history. There was a pilgrim and stranger mentality. And we have, one of the challenges that we have as a North American Anabaptist community now is that we have never lived this long in one place without being persecuted. And our ancestors came here, they saw themselves as Swiss German Mennonites who came here because of persecution. And so martyrdom and persecution was very much of the history and tradition of our community. So Mennonite churches and Amish churches are probably one of the only places where you hear the phrase being prayed that we thank God that we can worship unmolested and undisturbed. Because it's part of our martyr mentality that we have a background and a complex of persecution, and it was part of the psyche of the community that, and part of the isolation, the separation that became isolation was a reaction to persecution. But now we've lived here for 200 years and we're not persecuted anymore. We're a tourist attraction, and we've actually turned our identity into our own economic benefit. And so if you are Amish or Mennonite and you build something, it can be worth twice as much as the same thing built by a non-Amish person. And surveys done in Lancaster County, they were saying that 91% of non-Amish and Mennonite people consider Amish and Mennonite-produced products to be a superior value to products that are not Amish and Mennonite-produced. And so we have turned our identity. It's become an economic tool for us. And part of the reason why people stay in the community is because of the economic value of being in the community. And because it's become an economic tool for us. And so if you are a Mennonite or an Amish carpenter, it may help you to get more jobs than if you are a non-Amish, non-Mennonite carpenter. And so part of the price of leaving the community is that you lose that tool that you have for business purposes. Part of the tradition in history was being the quiet in the land. We don't stir up trouble. And what we traded in exchange for security was we gave up our zeal for evangelism, and we allowed ourselves to be isolated in order for safety. Part of the tradition in history was work hard, be stable. There's a value placed on hard work and diligence. And then there's a German term, Gelassenheit, which Donald Crable and Stephen Nault in their book Amish Enterprise say, Gelassenheit stands in sharp contrast to the proud, aggressive spirit of individualism afloat in modern culture. The meek stance of Gelassenheit unfolds as individuals yield to higher authorities, the will of God, the ordnung of the church, ordained leaders, parents, and teachers. As the core value of this ethnic culture, Gelassenheit collides with the heartbeat of modernity, individual achievement. Whereas moderns cheer self-fulfillment and individual rights, the Amish cherish subdued and humble persons who are willing to give up some personal freedom in return for a durable and visible ethnic identity. The Amish encounter with the world of commerce is indeed a struggle between the quiet and modest habits of Gelassenheit and the efficient, high-tech ways of modernity. So what is the extent of our assimilation? How have things changed? Well, first of all, there's economic assimilation. We have become part of the North American marketplace. In a time when most of our goods and services were traded and provided to other Anabaptist people, today that's changed. Most of our people no longer work on the farm or no longer work in agriculture. We're producing things that are sold in the marketplace. We're producing things that not only are in the national marketplace, but are also in the global marketplace. And so we have become a part. We depend on the cash income from non-Mennonite people, non-Anabaptist people, in order for the sustenance of our families. There's linguistic assimilation. We speak the trade language of North America. If we are going to trade with non-Mennonite, non-Anabaptist North American people, we have to speak their language. And so the economics have forced us into linguistic assimilation. Very few people in our communities under the age of 40 speak the German language. That has an impact on how we think. It has an impact on how we conceptualize ideas. It has an impact on how we see ourselves in relationship to the larger society. Because you see, our grandparents who lived in relative isolation and who had sporadic encounters with the English world felt uncomfortable with that. And language was part of that we don't belong mentality. But today, we don't know the German language. We haven't been raised with the German language. We're very comfortable with English. And so the whole term of using English people for non-Anabaptist people has sort of lost its meaning because we're all English people. And we largely use the English language. There's also been lifestyle assimilation. We live in a middle to upper middle class North American lifestyle. We see ourselves as part of the culture of North America. We see ourselves first as Americans and Canadians, not as Swiss, German, Anabaptists. And I would suggest to you that our grandparents' primary identity was Swiss, German, Anabaptists, Swiss, German, Mennonites, and then Canadian or Americans after that. Today, we see ourselves primarily as Americans, but we're Mennonites. And it's a secondary thing. Economics, I would suggest to you, is the thing that changes our rules more easily than anything else. We have our rules that almost can't be changed, but the thing that drives change more than anything else is economics. It was fascinating to me. I was in a church conference a few months ago, and they were having a discussion on life insurance. And they were saying, we have a problem because our guidelines say that our members are not allowed to have life insurance, but in fact, we know we have people who have life insurance because they were required to get life insurance on loans they took out from the bank. So we either have to change our rules or we have to say people can't have life insurance. What was fascinating to me that I got the perception, maybe I was wrong, but I got the perception from listening to the discussion that there were a fair number of people who would have been very comfortable with just leaving the rules the way they were But acknowledging that, yes, people have life insurance and they have to do that, so you know that and it's not their fault, they have to do it, but we can't change the rules. Then there were people who were saying, no, we must change the rules, the world's changed and we need to have life insurance now, and in these we should set up a thing, in these conditions you can have life insurance. There was one person who got up and said, well, maybe we're looking at this backwards, and if our values and our principles tell us that we shouldn't have life insurance, maybe we have to say we can't borrow money. Well, that didn't go anywhere because, if you don't borrow money, and he kind of followed that up with saying, well, maybe we just have to farm and do business on a smaller scale so that we don't have to get life insurance. Well, that seemed, you can't do that either. And so the whole thing, I don't know where it's all going to come out. But I think that it's frustrating and confusing to young people when they have ideas about things they'd like to see change and it can't be changed. But let it affect the economics of the middle-aged people and the older people, and then the rules can change because it has to be done based on money. The amount of money we have also brings us all kinds of options and choices that we didn't have before. And, one of the things about us as conservative Anabaptists is we are much better at abstinence than we are at moderation. So if anything... If something is at all dangerous, it's much easier for us to say, no, you can't do that at all. So, television, some of those things, we're like, no, that, absolutely not. Not at all. What we're not good at is saying, there's some danger, there's some benefits. How can we use this with moderation? How can we do the good and not the bad? And so what happens to us then is we learn not to do anything. But then there's things that we have to do, like eating, and we don't know how to do moderation because we're not taught moderation and we can't abstain from eating, so we're in trouble there. So we turn it into something, and isn't it fascinating that we raise money to feed people overseas who are starving by stuffing ourselves at relief sales? It's kind of a strange idea that we can, really save the world from hunger by overeating. It's a strange quirk of our mentality. So now we come down to the question of the internet. Now the fascinating thing about the internet is it's come to the point where you almost have to have access to the internet to do business, right? So it's awfully hard for us. So suddenly it's like the old joke about how to put a Mennonite into a quandary, offer him free beer. He doesn't, brings two of his values into conflict. And the internet is doing that in our communities because if we don't have internet access, it's going to restrict our ability to do business and to function in the marketplace, but we also see it, we also recognize it's a dangerous thing. And our response to those kinds of things is often abstinence. But now we say yes. But you know what's going to happen? We're going to be in a real bind because television is a watershed issue. And pretty soon, the internet and television are going to be the same thing. So we're coming up to a real quandary in something that has become a watershed issue and something that we have to do business. And I don't know how we're going to answer those questions. But what I'm saying to you is economics drives those decisions. And we are no longer willing to take economic sacrifices in order to live out what we think are biblical principles. One man was telling me that in their church they were having a discussion about whether they should allow people to have beards or not. And that's a fascinating thing in our culture. Like in some churches you have to have a beard and in some churches you can't have a beard. And this church was discussing whether men would be allowed to have beards. And one of the men said he's in favor of having beards because when he has a beard it gives him more recognition in the community as a Mennonite person and he can charge higher prices for his jobs as a carpenter as a Mennonite person, and so he's in favor of having beards. But economics, what I'm saying is, if we were honest, many of our decisions come down to economics. Values assimilation. We've adopted the values of conservative, Republican, middle America. We live in houses similar to those of middle-class, non-Anabaptist people. We drive vehicles that are similar to middle or upper-class, middle America. You can have a Lincoln Navigator as long as it's not red or yellow. And But then we have a list of things. As long as you wear a plain suit some Sunday mornings of the year to church, you're living a separated, modest, simple lifestyle. But can you drive a Lincoln Navigator to church with your plain suit? Is that a contradiction? And what I'm saying, we don't need a list of vehicles we're not allowed to drive. We don't need more things to check off. But somehow we have to deal with the incongruities of our lifestyles. And we have to say, no, if you're wearing a plain suit because of simplicity and modesty and a simple lifestyle, the Lincoln Navigator doesn't fit. And young people see that inconsistency. And it doesn't make our vision a compelling vision. Religious affiliation. We are adapting to the North American evangelical church world. The results of assimilation are that we see ourselves as Americans or Canadians, not Swiss, German, Anabaptists. We see ourselves standing on the sidelines of the North American evangelical world, not fully understanding our differences. We've accepted the idea of the United States as a Christian nation. Much of our spiritual input comes from people like James Dobson, Bill Gothard, Chuck Swindoll, Max Licato, Adrian Rogers, Rick Warren, Bruce Wilkinson, Charles Stanley. And we have a much easier time accepting George Bush as a man chosen by God to be president than we did Bill Clinton. And we see the conflict between the Western world and the Muslim world as a cosmic battle between good and evil, and we know that we're on the side of good. Even though the Muslim world, some of their motivation is because of all the pornography and all the degradation that comes out of North American society, and yet we are convinced that it's a battle between good and evil, and our side is the good. We're losing our concept of the separation of church and state. And I cringe when I hear Americans talking about the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq and saying, boy, we're really showing those guys something. Who's the we? How can we as Anabaptist people say we when something like that is happening? Where is our global identity? Where is our global vision? And you see, those things demonstrate the fact that we see ourselves primarily from an American context. And we begin to see God as an American. And God is not an American or a Canadian. God sees the globe. I'm far more concerned. Well, I shouldn't say more concerned, but I think that the Constantinian approach of George Bush to religion and government may do more damage to the North American church than the personal decadence of Bill Clinton ever did. But what I'm saying is we've been drawn into a Republican, middle-class American mindset, and we're losing our concept of the separation of church and state. We've defined a separation with a list of things, and we've made the list. And you check off all those things, and you're living a separated lifestyle. And my sadness for the conservative Mennonite church today is that we've maintained the list of things that prove to ourselves our separateness, but we're losing the heart values and the heart attitudes that go with them. And it's become a form of religion without a heart. We've assimilated economically, linguistically, and in many other ways, and somehow we need to prove to ourselves that we're still separate from the world, and so we create the checkoff list that proves to us that we're separate from the world. But when we do that, then it becomes terribly important that that list never changes. Because if the list ever changes, we may be becoming worldly. And the problem is, we may already be worldly. And you can do all that stuff and still be worldly. The definition of, we need to redefine what's being worldly. And we need to be honest about worldliness. And so we fear if any of those things change, all we can do is we point to the bigger conferences and say, see where they are today? If you change anything on the list, that's where we're going to be 20 years from now. And so don't change any of the details. In some cases, the maintenance of the list becomes the highest priority of the group. The unspoken rule is that nothing can ever change, and anybody who asks questions, maybe perhaps with a motivation of trying to understand, becomes a threat. We fail to distinguish between the items on the list that are mandated by Scripture and those that are lifestyle choices that we've made. And we fail to see the disconnection between the list and our everyday lives. The youth see it. The outside world sees it. People around us see it, but we don't see it because we've been raised with it. C.S. Lewis writes about what I think he calls chronological snobbery. And it's the thought that each generation thinks that they've reached the perfect balance in life. Everything that comes before me is uninformed and naive, and everything that comes after me is poorly thought out and dangerous. And in some ways, we as conservative Mennonites have frozen a set of rules from when we left the conferences in the 60s and 70s, and we're putting a lot of energy into maintaining that list. But things are changing. And I think that the greatest threats to the conservative Mennonite church today are either continued assimilation into North American evangelical world or irrelevance. And we may either become a part of the larger North American evangelical church, or we may maintain our distinctions, but in such isolation and with so little heart and vision that we really become irrelevant to what God wants to do in the world.
I was enjoying this day until it started getting convicting. I've already thanked the brothers for sharing, but I want to say thanks again. You're speaking to us, and you're letting your experience and the work of the Lord in your life, you're speaking to us out of that, and I think it's significant. Thank you. Once again, we'll invite the responders and the speakers to take their places at the tables. Yes, Ryan. Ryan's suggesting that everyone stand, and while they're taking their places, and I see some nods that that's a great idea. This is not a break, though. Okay. I would remind the ones up here that if you could at least maybe lean toward the mics when you speak, it'll help with the recording and with the sound. We still want you to look at each other and talk to each other, but if you could work with us a little bit on that, we'd appreciate it. You can be seated. We'll follow the same format. You kind of know each other a little bit better now. You know what the themes are that are burning on each other's hearts. And once again, you have a chance to talk with each other about these questions. And Melvin, give you a chance to respond and to ask questions. Let me just say this, though. At the end, I want to give you the three responders. I'm going to ask you a specific question. That is, as we close today, I want you to have a chance to reemphasize something that you've heard today that you think is very, very important. And so if there's one thing that you've heard that you really want to affirm, I'll give you a chance at the end of this panel to say that. But for now, Melvin, go ahead.
I want to thank you, brethren, for speaking clearly. I'm just going to, first of all, tell you what I think I heard you say, and then maybe a question or so along the line. David, I heard you saying that we've got to keep the generations together. And at least I heard you hint at the idea that, at a leadership idea. Now, you didn't use the term leadership, but the way you talked about it is, I think, something having to do with the respect for elders. Maybe is what I is the idea I heard there. I wouldn't mind hearing you talk a little bit more about that, not just immediately now. I want to walk through what I heard all of you say and then maybe come back to that, but you can be thinking about that question there. What should that look like? I would like if you could be real practical about that. Does that mean that we have, we just assume that our bishops will be 50 and older or 60 and older? Does it mean that we have Sunday school classes where we mix them rather than separate them into youth and young men and adults and, older men and all that? Or could you give us some stuff on that? Okay, you could be thinking about that while I continue here. I also heard you challenge us on our relation to the evangelical community. On one hand, warning us that it's got its dangers. On the other hand, telling us that we ought to avoid becoming isolationist. In other words, I hear you saying we have to somehow connect with the broader Christian community. At the same time, we have to, it's important for us to maintain some distinctive something. And I know that's a question that's been beat to death. But nevertheless, I give it to you again, or just ask you to maybe tell us a little bit more about what you're thinking there. Presentation was moving. It truly was, and very, very challenging. So you said quite a few things here. We've got to get over get our eyes off this thing of retirement. I like that number of things you said here. Maybe a question that you could wrestle with a bit. Well, maybe a key word that I heard you use was a word like a challenge. Or conquest was even a very strong word you used. That somehow men are attracted to the idea of conquest. Some of you have had me as students know that I feel very strongly the same way. However, there's a question. It's pretty easy to talk about a person who is about to take a box full of Bibles, let's say, for lack of another terminology, into China, past checkpoint A, B, and C, and so the danger levels are up and everything that's involved there. You can see this issue clearly. We're kind of attracted to that kind of challenge. First, do you agree, and again, you can answer this later, but be thinking about it. Do you agree that that not everybody will be called to that? Okay, for example, we're going to have huge numbers of people, I guess, who are carpenters and farmers, and they make up these core communities where these people come from. What does that conquest look like to them? Or what should it look like to them? Is this just maybe a select few who are called to this, but just exactly how can that look like or be something that they're involved in conquering, and they're called to that same thing? So I just affirm, I really, really like the emphasis. I've never quite known how to translate it into shoe leather for the typical young man in my community. Who is a fine young man, doing a good job, but maybe doesn't have that same feel. Merle, I don't know if we've read the same books or not. But again, some of you have had me as students, heard me harping on these same issues quite a bit. I hear you saying things are driven by economics. Okay. So how can we manipulate this economical thing then? If that's the driver, if that's the engine that really makes it go, Well, then there must be a way to get in there and say, okay, here are the three or four things that we ought to do with economics that would help to correct some of these things that you were talking about. You understand the question? And so I wouldn't mind hearing you talk just a little bit about, so, okay, we admit it's the driver. How can we instruct the driver? Maybe it's a question here to help us out on that thing. The points you bumped on, I just really want to affirm, I guess you're aware of this, seldom has a generation lived in a transitional era like we do. It's incredibly transitional. I'm only 49 years old, but I'm old enough to remember a little bit of the era that you're talking about when you talk back there when we were all agrarian, almost. boy, those transitions, I take it we haven't done all so well, real well with them. And again, I hear you saying that the transitions really were driven by economics. Maybe a question here is, should we remain agrarian? But that's not quite the right question, but was there a way to somehow have anticipated this and have addressed it ahead of time? Or what are we going to do about this thing, I guess is the question. Okay, enough said there for overview. I'd just come back to you, David, now and see if you've thought enough about this question. Tell us how the elders and the young folks can get together.
Yes, well, it's certainly a very practical question, and as an older person, I need to be a little careful how I respond to that. I don't think that this is resolved by an older person demanding respect from the younger ones. I think if there's going to be respect, it's because an older person commands respect rather than saying, this is what you've got to do. I think that there are some things that we can do to give consideration to the value, the contribution that the different age groups make. And of course, you asked whether the Sunday school classes should intermingle or whether they should be more segregated according to age. And we have actually done some of that mixing up and putting different age groups together, have pretty much gone back to more segregation, the younger classes, letting them meet together. We've also had younger men, single fellows, who were assigned to teach an adult men's class because we felt that was a good place to start them out. And it has been satisfactory, I feel. And so I would again come back to the thing that we don't, it's issues that we can't make rules to address, but there are real issues and we should try to work at them, I'm going to say, with sanctified creativity rather than a certain formula. And on the question of aging, I needn't tell you that that people don't necessarily get better with age. There is the opposite that eventually sets in. And I do have an understanding with the team of ministers I work with that if they become aware that I'm no longer, or that my ministry is no longer a net asset, as we wade in on the other side, before I do, I want them to tell me. So I don't want to glorify aging beyond its proper proportions.
Somebody else want to interact with David here is fine. Well, I appreciate that. Val, what are you thinking there about the conquest issue?
Tomorrow I will probably plan to talk a little bit more about that area, but just a few thoughts right now. The I see businessmen living this out in numbers of different places. I know people personally who are doing more than just the job. They are meeting with the families and marriages of the guys that are being hired by them, and their goal is not just to construct a house, but to continue to develop the homes and the lives of the men that they're working with. I think that's a practical way within our culture. And it looks very different than the young man who's hauling Bibles into a closed access country, but it's just as much a part of building the kingdom as what that is. I see a number of young people involved in the Lancaster Children's Choir, another good example of them walking out of their own recreational evenings or whatever and spending time with underprivileged young people, loving them well, teaching them, and that's great. I hear of young men who are getting together with the other young men in their churches and just spending time praying together, examining their hearts together, opening up on real men's questions, and I'm sure the ladies are doing that as well. Those are the kind of things that I would see as being a part of this bigger package of conquest. And some of it's going to happen in other foreign fields, some of it's going to happen in our backyards, in our own houses.
Good. So I hear you saying that essentially, if you'll step out of your front door and engage with your neighbor, you're going to run into the same kinds of motivating issues mm-hmm. that the person does who's over there in the foreign field.
Yeah, particularly as we encounter people who are not from our own background. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of trauma out there, a lot of homes that are in distress, and we can enter into that kind of battlefield within a half mile of our houses, probably. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of places to conquest locally and internationally.
It's about as dangerous to be interacting with an angry, drunk husband as it is to be trying to get Bibles across the border.
That's right. That's right.
And they are oftentimes a next-door neighbor or somebody just mm-hmm. nearby. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I like that challenge. I did hear you saying engage. If you engage, you'll find this conquest issue right in front of you, so appreciate that. Thanks for speaking to it. Merle.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked the question, because I think that I'm not against wealth, and I don't think that we should be taking vows of poverty and not taking advantage of the opportunities we have to acquire wealth. But what I think we need is God's perspective of the world and a global perspective. And we tend to live at the level of the people around us. And if the people around us are all North Americans, that's a different standard of living than if we're thinking globally. And we look at, we may not think we're rich by standards of people in our own local community, but by world standards, we are the wealthy people of the world. And when you look at the Industrial Revolution in the middle 1800s, England was the driving economic force, and God brought out of that a large missionary movement, and some of the circuit riding Methodist preachers in the American Midwest were funded through donations from Great Britain. And the scripture says that people should work so that they have to give to those who need. And I'm a firm believer that every North American should get out of North America for some period of their lives and make friends and learn to know people outside of North America, because it puts our wealth in context and gives us ideas about what we can do and how much has God brought into our hands, not for us to drive a better vehicle and live in a better house, into the hands of the emerging church in the third world and in other parts of the world. And you know, you hear about the crisis in Africa, where today there's over 10 million AIDS orphans in Africa. By 2010 or 12, there's going to be predicted to be 20 million AIDS orphans. What are we going to do about that as a church? Are we going to keep expanding our own lifestyles, or are we going to do something about 20 million AIDS orphans in Africa? I just don't think we see the world the way God sees it. And I think some of our resources are just coming into our hands to be passed on. And I remember when we lived in Haiti, it was in in the spring of the year. It was right at the end of their dry season, and so people had eaten pretty much the stuff that was in their gardens, and we had a Sunday morning service at church, and we had a Sunday morning service that was over about 12:30, and then the Sunday evening service started at 5. And at the end of the morning service, the pastor said, "Now I know that a lot of you people didn't have anything to eat before you came to church, and you don't have anything to eat when you go home, and so we're going to sing. We're going to have a song service from now until the evening service, and if you don't have anything to eat at home, I invite you to stay here and sing, because when you sing, you don't think about being hungry." And probably 60% of the church stayed and sang all of Sunday afternoon so they wouldn't think about being hungry. And I just ask, what does God think when he looks at the world and he sees some of his children singing on Sunday afternoon so they don't think about being hungry, and others of us squandering our wealth on things that are pretty meaningless? I knew a man, my father worked for him actually, and he, it was in the 60s when people were first starting to get summer homes and cottages in the mountains and at the seashore and stuff, and he was a wealthy businessman, and later in his life he sold one of his businesses for $110 million and another one of his businesses for a similar amount of money. I don't know what he got for the second one. But somebody made a comment to him one time that he should buy a cabin in the mountains. And he said, "I will not own two homes until everybody in the world has at least one." And somehow we have to get that kind of mindset. And we have to look at what we have. And we have to look at people in other parts of the world. Just 2 months ago, we sat with a lady in Thailand who is taking students into her home, has no income, no source of funding, and next year she's going to have 20 students living in her home, and she's praying every day for the money to feed those students and share the gospel with them. And I just, you know, but we have to get out there and make friends and know people like that. Or it's so easy for us to just go on and expand our lifestyles. And so I'm just a firm believer that everybody, we need to go away and learn to know people and see what God's doing in other parts of the world. And we won't be able to, it won't be a chore to give. We'll be just looking for where can I get more to pass on. And I'm pretty passionate about that. I really think that our wealth is a tool and God's given it to us. And who knows how long it's going to last. But when our wealth is not a result of our spiritual faithfulness, our wealth is a tool that we have. And when God is done using North America's wealth to bring the gospel to the world, it won't be here. And we need to use it when we can.
Thank you. Roy, I think we'll move your direction.
Okay, I heard you brethren, I think, all talking about the pressures of acculturation, assimilation, and the question that came to my mind is, why is that pressure greater today than it has been in generations past? Is there something we can learn there?
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.